Do you love bread and butter, toast and jam, pasta, beer, and all things gluten? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk with a former bread-baking, wheat-loving guy who experienced a life-changing setback when he was diagnosed with a severe wheat allergy, celiac disease. Our guest will share his memoir of bread loss and how he learned to cope. And we'll also discuss why he and many others may have become allergic to wheat and barley and rye and oats. And we will welcome your questions and your stories, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Do you have celiac disease? Or do you know someone who does? How has it changed your life? Do you miss, do you mourn the loss of bread or other wheat-filled foods? Let us know. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Paul Graham, who is an associate professor of English at Lawrence University in upstate New York. His writings have appeared in the Best Food Writing Anthology twice. He is the author of In Memory of Bread, a memoir. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being with us. This is really interesting to me because I love all these, I love bread and pasta and all of these things that you can no longer eat. That's got to be a shock.
I'm getting used to it. That's the good news, I guess.
Yeah.
4 years now, I think, I have gone without eating wheat. And it is something that you acclimate yourself to because you have to. And yet, one of the things that you quickly discover when you can't have them anymore is that those foods are everywhere, and they underpin a lot of our traditions, a lot of our rituals, a lot of our holidays. So yes, it's definitely something to get used to.
Yeah. Well, let's hear your story. You loved eating your wife's bread. You were a cook yourself. You were a home brewer. I mean, your life and hobbies kind of revolved around bread things.
Yeah, for a while they did. I guess what started the whole bread baking thing was the book Artisan Bread in 5 Minutes a Day, which was published 5-6 years ago now. And for those people who don't know the premise of this book, it's actually really quite simple and addictive, too. What you do is you mix up a bunch of dough and you keep it in your refrigerator where it ferments and ages naturally. And whenever you want a loaf of bread, you take it out and you bake it. And it worked really, really well. And my wife and some of her friends were cooking their way through that book. And it was wonderful because it was, something unlike what we were able to get at the grocery store, for sure. And simultaneous to that, a good friend of mine and I decided that we were going to try to become self-sufficient in the beer department, basically, and just launch ourselves into home brewing and make a variety of seasonally appropriate ales and just get to know that process better. We started off with home kits, and we were starting to mull the transition to moving to all grain. And right around the time that we had about 20 gallons of beer put up, aging away, this came on me and changed everything.
Yeah, you tested some of your beer, and then you felt sick, and it wasn't a hangover.
Well, yeah, and I don't want to say that the beer and the bread necessarily caused this. There's a lot of scholarship out there on potential causes, and nobody knows what the causes are. But that's essentially what happened. In fall of 2012, I got, very sick with gastrointestinal symptoms, and whereas in the past they ran their course and went away, this time it was here to stay. And I basically, for 6 to 8 weeks, didn't eat very much, and my intestines approached a state of atrophy, lost a lot of weight, and I was, after that all came to a head, admitted to the hospital because my blood panels were so bad that I needed blood transfusions to address the iron deficiency anemia that came over me because of not absorbing any nutrients.
Yeah. Well, and you were misdiagnosed, or it took a long time to figure out what was going on. But
yeah.
So because what, doctors just don't know that much about celiac disease?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely getting better. There's more awareness, and I think that people, when they don't feel well, are beginning to experiment with the usual suspects for intolerances. But my story is not unlike a lot of celiac disease stories in that the first thing my physicians thought I was suffering from was a GI parasite, a bacterial infection, maybe a viral infection. And so I think, and this is true of a lot of cases, their first response was to prescribe antibiotics. And when that didn't work, they shifted to another antibiotic. And when that didn't work, they shifted to another antibiotic. And this is the stage where things really started to get serious, and my doctor said, okay, well, I think you might have some other things going on. We're going to do some imaging. And I've often asked myself, you know, if I had been, you know, not in a rural area, but let's say right on top of a teaching hospital or something like that, would I have been diagnosed more rapidly? But the statistics don't actually bear that out. You know, the average time to diagnosis in this country from first presentation of the symptoms to diagnosis is right around 6 years. And not everybody gets as sick as I did. And in fact, if I look back at my own personal history, I think that I was suffering from it for several years prior. I just didn't know it because it didn't get bad enough for me to pay attention, or it didn't get bad enough long enough for me to pay attention. But yeah, misdiagnosis, very common.
Yeah. And I mean, is celiac disease something that can be easily diagnosed with a blood test or what?
Yes, it can. Yes, it can. I mean, the gold standard is an intestinal biopsy, where they actually take, make an image of the microvilli, which are the tiny hair-like projections in the intestine, which are responsible for absorbing nutrients. And they measure what's called the crypts between those microvilli. And if the crypts aren't deep enough, then there has been some atrophying and some flattening of that surface. And it's why you're not absorbing anything. That's the gold standard, but you can also test for antibodies, and there are other blood tests that they can do too. So the short answer is yes, actually, it's a very easy test to do. Anybody can probably do it at a local hospital. The other thing that I could have done, which I did not do, was I could have experimented with my diet. And that's kind of interesting to me just from an historical perspective because, you know, celiac disease has been in the human population for actually a couple thousand years, at least as far as we know. And the first attention that it received with any concentration, again, as far as we can tell, is in the 19th century. And people have been slow to suspect bread or wheat, more generally, gluten, as having, like, immunogenic properties. You know, those 2 months when I was really, really sick, what was I eating? I was eating things that I thought would be gentle on my stomach, like toast and tea.
Oh, yeah.
I was eating a plain bowl of pasta, right? Because those are things that culturally I think we've been taught to think are good. I mean, rice and bananas and applesauce are also good, too. But when you're sick for that long, you want a little bit of variety. And, you know, back when this disease was first being studied in London, in the 19th century, doctors came close but didn't quite discover that it was bread or gluten because they allowed their patients, you know, slices of toasted bread. So if I had eliminated that and if I'd been maybe paying a little bit more attention to, I don't know, diet trends, that kind of thing, I might have discovered it more quickly.
Yeah. Could have been eliminating these foods from your diet just to see if it made a difference. Yeah.
Yeah, but for some reason, I just never thought that was something that I would need to do because I had been, I guess, blessed to have no diet, no intolerances, no allergies, you know, my entire life. So it made no sense to me that it would come on like that when I was, you know, in my 30s.
Yeah, well, I thought about that, too. Is that, you know, why isn't this something that if you have an allergy to wheat or you are, you know, intolerant to gluten, why did it show up in your 30s rather than, I don't know, in your, you know, when you're an adolescent, for example?
That's like the million-dollar question for a lot of diseases, right? Like, first of all, in order to get celiac disease, you need three factors to be in place. You have to, A, be consuming gluten, and I was. You need to have the genetic predisposition for it in the form of what's known as HLA, immune response markers. It's estimated that in America, about half the population actually carries one of the two HLA markers responsible for celiac disease, either DQ2 or DQ8. And then what you need is some kind of an environmental trigger, and that's what causes the gene, so to speak, as I understand it anyway, to flip on, and that's what we don't understand. Maybe it's an environmental thing like stress, maybe it's surgery for some people, pregnancy, you know, those sorts of things which can cause changes in the body. But, you know, we don't
I didn't realize that. I'm assuming that everybody knows what celiac disease is, and you touched on it, but it is an allergy to wheat or other grains that contain gluten?
Yeah, it is specifically an autoimmune syndrome. And what happens is, in the presence of gluten, the body attacks its own healthy tissue in the intestines. It is a case of misrecognition by the immune system, and gluten is operative in that.
And it could be it's in wheat or barley or rye or even
wheat,
oats?
Barley, spelt, yeah. Rye. Some of the grains that are making a comeback right now that are very popular, like farro, bulgur, any of those grains, and sometimes oats. You have to be careful of cross-contamination, obviously. Any grain that is handled in a place that has that is also handling gluten, for instance, glutinous grains, stands a chance to be cross-contaminated, and that's sometimes the case with oats.
Mm.
I seem to have won the lottery because my body actually appears to respond to the protein in oats, avenin, in the same way that it responds to gluten. So I can't even have so-called gluten-free oats.
Oh no!
This is a tough thing. Like, because when you're cooking, you're cooking with one hand tied behind your back.
So what's going on with this autoimmune? The reaction is it attacks the little hairs that are in your intestines, and that then stops you from absorbing nutrients.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, as I understand it, yeah, I should probably say that I'm not a physician.
Right.
I'm not an immunologist. I'm not a gastroenterologist. What I have done is looked pretty deeply into the available scholarship on it and tried to synthesize it for people in the context of my story so that we can understand a little bit more what's going on.
Right, right. And the symptoms can vary, but they're usually GI tract type symptoms.
Well, yeah, yes and no. I mean, the most common symptoms definitely do cluster around that. Some researchers say that over 300 symptoms actually have been associated with celiac disease. And perhaps because it's an autoimmune disorder, it can come over a person with some idiosyncrasy. And, diseases like, for instance, fibromyalgia sometimes gets misdiagnosed as celiac disease because, you know, fatigue is part of it, joint pain.
Yeah.
It's really kind of a long list of things that you can experience.
We're going to take our break, and when we come back, our guest, Paul Graham, will talk about how the diagnosis of celiac disease changed his life, and we will welcome your own questions and experiences. Do you or does someone you know have celiac disease? What is it like not eating bread or other grain-filled foods? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Paul Graham is our guest, an associate professor of English at St. Lawrence University in upstate New York, author of In Memory of Bread, a memoir. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Paul Graham, who is the author of a memoir, In Memory of Bread. It's about how he learned that he had a severe wheat allergy, celiac disease, and how he coped with that, how he had to stop eating all things gluten, including bread and pastas and beer. We wonder if you have any questions for him. And again, he's not a doctor, but we welcome your questions and your experiences. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm not surprised. Our lines are full right now with callers, Paul Graham. But I wanted to ask you, yeah. I mean, once, all right, you finally got the diagnosis. Yeah. And then what?
Well, I mean, you clean out your house. You clean out your kitchen. You have to get a lot of gluten out of the house because if you're especially sensitive to it, and I am, you know, as little as an eighth of a teaspoon is enough to make you sick, a couple of crumbs. So you're basically giving all of your wheat and flour away. You're giving your grape nuts away and yeah. all of that stuff. And then what you're doing is you're going through the very strange process of visiting the gluten-free section of the grocery store, where things are, thankfully, I have to say, the options are increasing, in part because of the trend in gluten-free eating. But things are also a little strange, a little more expensive, and if you really loved wheat, a lot less delicious in yeah. some cases.
I was going to say that I'm not gluten intolerant, but I experimented a little bit just to try. I made some cookies that with gluten free flour. I don't know. I think it was yeah. rice flour. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And they were okay. But you know, there was something different about them. They were okay though. And then, but yeah, some of those breads are not so great.
Yeah, and that's really where you begin to plug into an interesting culinary history. Because one of the things that I discovered is this kind of alchemy that you carry out in your kitchen, trying to turn rice into wheat, is actually an old project. It's an old project. People have been doing it for hundreds, thousands of years, because when wheat crops failed, as they often did, they still had to have a loaf of something on the table. And people have been making loaves out of ground nuts and beans and trying to leaven it for a very long time. And there was something comforting in learning that when I was doing that research for the book, because it really did suggest to me that I wasn't alone in feeling haunted by bread.
Yeah.
That, you know, people have been doing this for a while.
Well, in fact, you tell the story, too, about how, I mean, little things you don't think about, the holiday buffet at a friend's house. Tell us
yeah.
that story.
This was like a couple of weeks, actually, after I had been diagnosed. I went to my friend's house for New Year's Eve, and most of what was on the table was glutinous, for sure, but she had thought of me. It was the first time that anybody did this for me, and it's a wonderful thing to do for somebody who has this kind of an intolerance happen to them all of a sudden. She had made a safe zone of the table, and there were a bunch of foods there for me, and it really helped. And then, of course, because it was New Year's Eve and there were a lot of people there, by the end of the evening, the buffet was a little disorganized.
Yeah.
And it was the first time that I had to ask myself, okay, well, what on this table is safe and what on this table is not safe? And I think because I still had not quite accepted what it was I was experiencing then, my diagnosis and what it meant, I just decided I didn't care for the night. It was kind of an interesting coincidence that it came at New Year's, because I was able to make that New Year's resolution that said, okay, I've got to give into this. I've got to accept this. Because the thing is, if you do not take care of yourself and you have celiac disease, you are at risk for some very serious consequences in the long term. Lymphoma is one of them. You really do have to take care of yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just a little bit of cramps or something. It can be super serious.
Yeah, and that's a big enough threat for me to take it very seriously. People ask me all the time, well, don't you cheat? What's your threshold? Do you figure out where it is and kind of like bump up against it without breaking through to the other side? And my answer is no, I never do. And I think probably in the 4 years that I've been diagnosed, I've probably had 4 or 5 brushes with it, places where I've gotten cross-contaminated. And it's serious enough for me that, you know, I don't want to go through it.
Well, that's what I was thinking about when I was going through your book and your story. And again, I don't have celiac disease, and I maybe eat too much bread, as witnessed by the scale. But I think about, you know, holiday gatherings and how we, you know, socialize around that table full of food, and how we break bread, and we, you know, the homey smell of bread baking in the oven and in the melted butter. I mean, and I don't mean to torture you with that. Or
I'm used to it by now.
Yeah, but that's what you think about that bread, that kind of imagery. And memory, and you're not able you're able to participate in some sense, but it's different.
Yeah, it is different. Thankfully, there are some great cookbooks out there. And in the process of writing this book, one of the things that I did was I talked with the people at America's Test Kitchen about the book that they put together at the time. It was the only one. They have another one now. But their book, How Can It Be Gluten-Free, they spent a tremendous amount of time. Jack Bishop, I interviewed him for the book. He told me it was the most difficult cookbook they'd ever done. Because they did have some very serious standards in making that book, and they wanted to create foods that those who were intolerant and those who were not could all enjoy together, because they were working from that recognition that it's not right to have, you know, a couple of things that are like ersatz foods over here and the real stuff for everybody else over there, right? And a number of those recipes are very good. They're also pretty difficult and expensive to make. And I think it will continue to get better, but I also think that there are only so many ways that you can make rice or millet or something like that behave like wheat. Historically, wheat has been a prized grain. And for a very good reason. It's delicious. it rises beautifully, and it does things that other grains can't.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk more about your story and what other observations you have about this as we move along, but I've been making callers wait for too long. Let's go to Mary in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
I understand that. Good morning. You have been diagnosed with celiac disease, too?
Yes, I have. I have been celiac resistant, or had celiac for 18 years now. I also have been a type 1 diabetic for about 52 years, and I also have thyroid disease, so everything is in the autoimmune category. But yes, I guess I would say it is torture to withdraw from gluten. I have always loved breads and pastas and pizza and all of that. And the ready available products are very expensive and not all that great. My husband describes a bread and pizza crust as like the back of a legal pad. And it's not fun. It's harder to deal with the gluten-free diet than it is the actual diabetes. I can always take more insulin if I'm going to be naughty on the diabetes diet, but there is no fallback plan for gluten-free.
Yeah, Paul?
Yeah, I would just second all of that. And it's interesting that you have all of those autoimmune issues clustering around each other. Has a physician told you why that might be?
Well, it's really difficult, I think, more so because a lot of the fallback plan for a gluten-free source of food is sugar and or fat.
Yeah, it that's absolutely true.
It plays a horrible game with the diabetes factor. So it's just kind of one of those walk-on-the-edge type things, and I do as much gluten-free as I possibly can. On occasion, if I'm out, I love bread. If I go to an Italian restaurant and they offer risotto on the menu, I'm so thrilled. And but I do on occasion have a piece of bread, and I do suffer. The headaches and the stomach discomfort are just terribly, just undescribable.
Yeah, and some people can cheat a little bit, Paul.
Yeah, no, the caller makes a great point that usually when you're eating the substitutions, you're eating something that is more calorically dense, maybe has a higher glycemic load, because you need more sugar and fat and salt to get the approximation of the taste of the real thing. And that's problematic for a lot of people who are shifting to a gluten-free diet. My wife and I actually, because I think we had the time and because we also are plugged into some good farms up here, we always made a lot of our foods from scratch. So in that way, the transition wasn't very hard for me because I wasn't losing a lot of prepared foods to begin with.
Yeah.
But if it's anything, it's a call really to consider taking control of your own cooking, and to learn how to cook and to get good at it.
Yeah, because I've seen some of those foods at the grocery store and heard the complaint that they are expensive.
And on average, 250% more expensive than their conventional counterparts.
Yeah, and that's because of the mass production of these foods that they have to have totally different facilities to do a gluten-free product.
Yeah, it's partly that. They do those that maintain a gluten-free facility have to pay for that. That's more expensive. Certification and testing, if they do that, is also an added cost. But also, these grains, are not all the time being grown in huge quantities, and so they're just more expensive to use. Grains like quinoa and teff. And even brown rice, and they're just more expensive to make anything out of.
Thank you, Mary, and thank you for sharing your story, and good luck to you. Martin in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Martin.
Hi, I'm a retired allergist. I want to make some comments about the terminology you've been using.
Sure.
Celiac disease is not an allergy. It's a completely different disease. There's a very different mechanism between the two. Somebody could theoretically be allergic to wheat and have rye or barley. They may be allergic to all three, but it's a different part of the immune system. The symptoms are very different.
All right, and I'm probably the one that used that. I said wheat allergy. Are they? Is it you have celiac disease? It's not necessarily just a wheat allergy, Paul.
No, it's an autoimmune disorder, and yeah, it's a good point. At the same time, I've know many people with celiac disease, actually, who, when they're out dining, because a server might not understand what a celiac disease diagnosis means or what an autoimmune disorder is, will actually refer to it as a wheat allergy because they feel that people understand that better. But the caller's absolutely right. It's not celiac disease and wheat allergy are two entirely different things.
Yeah, I was using some of the terminology on your book materials, calling it a wheat allergy, but that's easier to understand, perhaps. But you cannot have wheat, you cannot have any of these grains that contain gluten, including oats.
Well, oats don't contain gluten.
But if they're cross-contaminated.
They could potentially be cross-contaminated. I found out the hard way when I tried to reintroduce oats to my diet. I just like oats. I was feeling off for a little while. I went back to my gastroenterologist, and he drew some blood, and we figured out that, the antibody counts were elevated, and therefore, my body seemed to be responding to oats in the same way that it responded to gluten. Lots of people who have celiac disease can have oats. It's the complexity actually, the the comment about the allergy is suggesting this. The complexity of this is really, it's baffling, it's problematic, and it's challenging.
Yeah, and I appreciate the call to clarify that. Let's go to John in Manitouish next. Hello, John.
Good morning.
Morning.
I wanted to make sure folks understood that you could be tested negatively for celiac disease, but still be gluten intolerant. I was sick for 10 years and went through all kinds of tests and constantly being told that I wasn't gluten sensitive because I was celiac negative, but in fact, I'm gluten intolerant. So it's a really important point to make. I know other people who've had the same experience. Once you get off of gluten, you're fine, but you can, to just reemphasize, you can be negatively tested for celiac, but still be gluten intolerant.
Yeah, that's good, and I'm glad you pointed that out. But John, tell us what it's like. How did that change your life that you were gluten intolerant?
Well, it was in my 50s, so we'd been making our own bread for 30 years and eating natural foods for a long time. So it was quite a surprise to be ill from this. But anyway, within a month of eliminating all gluten based products, I was well after being sick for literally for 10 years and not being able to eat dinner and getting very thin and feeling sick all the time. So I want to add one thing. Everybody's kind of bemoaning how poor gluten-free products are. I would disagree. They're not. You can't make a wonderful scone quite as good, and you can't make bread quite as well, but we make awfully good bread now with and good pancakes and waffles, and there's a lot of good alternatives you can eat quite pleasurably these days on a gluten-free diet.
Yeah, the pancakes in particular.
We make great waffles with brown rice and white rice flour and so forth. So it's very doable.
A little less convenient sometimes, but
absolutely. And restaurants still aren't. We live up north. The restaurants still aren't totally tuned into this by any means, but.
I've often felt like those people who have gluten intolerance have, in public at least, a slightly more difficult case to make than somebody who has celiac disease because, I don't know, there's something about the word intolerance that people seem to doubt. Do you find that that's true for you, that if you tell somebody that you're gluten intolerant as opposed to celiac disease, they suggest, oh, well, you'll be okay?
I haven't found that. I think folks are open for the most part to hearing this. It's just been a revelation. I hadn't been aware that it was possible to be gluten intolerant until a friend came by and said she'd been going through many, many visits to the ER because of being terribly ill. And I had done the same thing, been in the ER many times with tremendous stomach pain and so forth. And she said she'd had the same issue and finally just gave up on gluten and was fine. And so that triggered me to go there. And so I just like to get the word out that this is something that's possible. You just can't. There is no test for gluten intolerance other than to stop eating gluten.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say, is that I've heard that some people doubt, well, really, does this exist? But in any case, he's better since he stopped consuming gluten, Paul?
Yeah, and if you think about it, whenever people doubt intolerance, is the first thing that I think is, we all have foods that don't agree with us. We all have things that we avoid because, I don't know, they give us indigestion or heartburn, or, you know, we just don't feel good when we eat them. So I don't see that there's any reason to doubt anybody saying that I'm intolerant to something or, you know, not intolerant to something, because we're very complex organisms, right?
Mm-hmm. We are talking with Paul Graham. He is an associate professor of English at St. Lawrence University in upstate New York. He is also the author of In Memory of Bread, a memoir, which tells his story about his diagnosis with celiac disease. And we are talking about what that was like for him, how he learned to cope with the loss of bread and all things gluten, some of his favorite things, like his own home brewing hobby and freshly baked bread that his wife would make. What about you? Do you have celiac disease? Are you gluten intolerant? Do you know someone who is? What's it like for you? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Paul Graham, who is the author of a memoir, In Memory of Bread, which tells his story about learning that he has celiac disease, which is an autoimmune disorder that he is not able to consume gluten, which includes grains like wheat and barley and rye. We're welcoming your questions for him. We're welcoming your own stories. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go next to Karen in Madison. Hi, Karen. Karen, are you there? Oh, I'm sorry. We lost Karen. She was going to share some funny stories of foods that she mistakenly ate. Call back, Karen, if you can. I'm sorry we weren't able to connect. Do you have any funny stories about foods that you mistakenly ate, Paul?
I don't know whether I have funny stories about foods that I mistakenly ate. The funniest story, I think, in hindsight, about a food that I ate was the day that I was diagnosed. I had been waiting to get the biopsy results back, and my doctor called me while I was out running some errands, and the first thing that I did after getting the call was I went to the local hotel lounge and ordered a Reuben sandwich and fries to go, and I thought for a moment with some detachment about what I was about to do to myself, and I thought, well, you know, this is the last one, so how much worse can things get? And I ate the whole thing in the car in the parking lot.
Oh,
and
gosh, it was almost like a last meal.
It was. And, you know, it just, I guess it underscores how out of it I was then. I can't believe I did it. But in hindsight, it's simultaneously dumb and also, I think, a little understandable. It's like, okay, well, I'm going to go out on my terms in a blaze of gluten. And I'm going to eat it. And I felt awful. I regretted it almost immediately. And you know, those are the sorts of things that stand out along the way. I haven't been cross-contaminated a whole lot. I tend to be really careful. My friends have been wonderful about, you know, welcoming me into their kitchens. They clean off cutting boards and, you know, go gluten-free for a night. So I haven't made too many mistakes. It's been intentional instead.
Yeah, let's go next to Paul in Grays Lake. Hello, Paul.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had one suggestion with regard to gluten-free bread that I and my mother came across, and it's worked out well. I have to mention specific brand names, if that's okay. That's the way
sure.
It goes. But Bob's Red Mill, I don't have a package in front of me yet, so I hope I'll get the name right. They have a few different gluten-free bread mixes. The one I'm thinking of is called Bob's Red Mill, Simply Wonderful Gluten-Free Bread Mix.
Mm-hmm.
Something about that mix is that a primary ingredient is garbanzo bean flour,
yep,
instead of the typical rice flour, and that I'm hoping we're getting a little more protein out of that, maybe a little less starch and such. It will make it a specific way, following the recipe on the package, but using specifically Rice Dream Original brand rice milk. I know we've tried others, and the flavor varies significantly. That's the one that just happens to really work well with this mix. And I found I could beef up the flavor to just subtly but significantly by adding a quarter teaspoon of almond extract to it. And you can either bake it in the oven or both for convenience, and because it comes up with a slightly denser loaf, make it in a bread mixer. And in the bread mixer, we also found that it would continue to brown on the cool-down setting. So for our particular bread mixer, letting it go into cool-down for 15 minutes and then popping it out seems to produce a perfect loaf. But it's a lot better than the alternatives, many of them, and you can make it at home.
Thank you very much, Paul. Do you, Paul Graham, have a reaction to that, or are you familiar with that brand name?
I am, actually. I found, I think, that bread mix exactly at our local store, and it was the first thing that I made that gave me some hope. I remember taking it out of the oven and being so excited by the appearance of that particular loaf that I took a picture of it.
Oh.
and sent it to a couple of my friends, and I said, okay, we're back. But the addition of rice milk and almond extract suggests, you know, some of the things that we're talking about, which is that when you're working with something that's not wheat and you're trying to make it behave like wheat, you really do need to, you know, give it a little lift with other ingredients to make it just get that much closer to what it is you're trying to taste.
Yeah, you know, a friend of mine told me, and I didn't know this, and maybe it's just her. She said that. Well, she said she is also, she cannot have dairy products as someone who has celiac disease because she says people often are lactose intolerant as well. It goes hand in hand. Does it for you too?
It doesn't for me.
Okay.
And I guess my response to that, I've heard about that, and my response has been that if your intestines are really damaged by celiac disease, it can take several years for them to completely recover. And my own thought is that those other intolerances that sometimes seem to pop up with celiac disease do get better as your intestines recover. I don't know whether that's true for everybody, but I know it's true for me. At first, I couldn't handle dairy for very well either, and that was for a couple of months. And for a while, I couldn't handle fish. And as I healed and as I got better, I was able to eat those things again, thank God.
Yeah.
Because I can't imagine having additional intolerances or allergies on top of celiac disease. And I know people who have them. You know, they can't have nuts and they can't have dairy. And then, you know, basically what you're doing is you're eating meat and fruits after that, and
yeah,
vegetables, of course.
Let's go next to Maxine in Chippewa Falls. Hello, Maxine.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd just like to echo what you said about garbanzo bean flour or other kinds of bean flour, like fava bean flour. I've developed a recipe for waffles that I would challenge anyone to determine that it between it and a wheat waffle. I make a pie. We also don't eat sugar. I make pie, and we use bananas for sweetener. And that is sugar, but there's at least other nutrients there. And it's pumpkin pie, and I use pecan as pie with pie crust.
Oh, does that ever sound good, Maxine? Your telephone line's a little bit fuzzy, so it's a little bit difficult to hear you, but I want you to come to the station right now and make those things. I guess the garbanzo bean flour and is a good alternative.
Yeah, bean flours and also almond meal and pecan meal are all really good substitutions, in part because of the protein content, I think. The high protein content, because gluten is a protein, you know, it allows that approximation to taste like you hope it will.
So many comments. I'm trying to. Rosalind on Facebook says, "I think I had celiac a long time before I figured it out. I was living in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and I found a health food store where I could get lots of information about food allergies, so this helped me be able to experiment with leaving out and reintroducing breads and pastas to my diet. I'm okay with rice pasta, but apparently not with with other things," so she's just sharing her story. Lorraine emailed that her daughter was diagnosed at age 12 in school. It is hard to be normal and eat with your friends and have lunch. Family has to be careful about what foods to make. She told her daughter that she has the healthiest diet compared to all of her friends to make her feel better, but it's very difficult. That must be hard, especially for a kid.
Yeah, you know, when you think about things like birthday parties and pizza parties and school buses stopping at restaurants after sports games, that kind of thing. If there's something that I've thought to myself in you know, connection to my good fortune here, it's that I had a childhood with all of those things. I had a really good run before I was diagnosed at 36, and there are people who just won't get to experience some of the flavors that a lot of us remember so fondly. And, you know, On the other hand, there are great substitutions, and things like ice cream stands are starting to carry like gluten-free ice cream cones and that sort of thing. But yes, I think it's especially difficult for kids.
Yeah, I was at the Memorial Union here at the UW-Madison campus, and I know it exists elsewhere, but and I didn't get it, but it was they were featuring a gluten-free beer. So what do you think of gluten-free beer?
Gluten-free beer is tough. it's tough. The stalwarts in the gluten-free beer industry for a long time used sorghum as the primary fermenting agent. And sorghum, for me, at least to my taste, it gets kind of chewy, and it's almost saccharinely sweet. I really don't enjoy the taste of sorghum beers. However, now what you're starting to see is really creative blends. Rice, of course, you can ferment rice, but you know there's a beer out of Montreal called Glutenberg that is making beer out of roasted chestnuts. There's a beer that's made partly out of lentils and tapioca maltodextrin, and these don't sound very good, but in fact they taste quite good, especially if they're made in the IPA style, because you've got that hop note to cover some of those slightly off flavors that come in gluten-free beer.
An email from Chuck, who says his wife had celiac for 10-plus years, says most gluten-free products have little nutritional value. White flour is enriched to make it nutritionally rich. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it's kind of what we were talking about a little while ago, that there's this sense sometimes that the gluten-free diet immediately means healthy, but you do have more sugar, you do have more fat, and yes, white rice is, pretty empty calories. There are a lot of nut and seed crackers out there. If you can tolerate, nuts and seeds, they make great crackers out of them. They're working their way into breads. But the idea that the gluten-free diet means automatically weight loss is not true, because if it leans too heavily on white rice, you're not getting a whole lot, and you're getting a huge amount of carbohydrates.
Yeah, so, what do you think needs to happen to make it more tolerable for people like you?
Well, the caller who identified a number of good pancake mixes and crackers and those sorts of things. Is absolutely right. The products are getting better all the time. And I was not diagnosed in the dark ages when, there wasn't a whole lot of innovation. I think actually there's only so far you can go. And I don't know whether we're at that point, but sometimes it seems like we've gone as far as we can to turn rice or other grains into wheat. My solution personally, and what I suggest to people to do, is to learn to cook from a culinary tradition that does not lean heavily on wheat. Because then what you're doing is you're using the recipes as they were designed, as they were written. You're using the foods as they were meant to be used. I'm thinking right now about Thai, Mexican, some Indian cuisines for sure. If you can add these to your repertoire and, learn to do more with lentils and spices and rice and yogurt and, all of those foods that come out of India or go into Indian cuisine, or if you can learn more about how to use corn masa, tortillas, arepas, that kind of thing, you will enjoy it. You'll get a little bit more joy in your cooking, and, you'll maybe develop a reputation as a person who does exotic and innovative things in your kitchen, and people want to come to your house.
Yeah, I think I want to do that anyway. thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Paul Graham is the author of In Memory of Bread, a memoir. He is an associate professor of English at St. Lawrence University in upstate New York. His writings have appeared in the Best Food Writing Anthology, and we thank him for his time. Thanks to producers Niaja Ellison, Brianne Chasso, and Kai Brito. And thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.